you're an adrenaline junkie, you're fearless, or you've got a death wish. None of that's true, right? I'm probably the most paranoid and cautious person you're likely to meet. That's why I'm still alive. Paranoia saves lives.
You've been on various amounts of tours. Army underwater bomb shelter team, airborne brigade.
So if someone's looking at a priority A, that meant that effectively the commander of the area was like, I am willing to risk the life of my bomb disposal officer to get this done.
Wow.
You've got like a 1,000-pound bomb, right? So that's 500 kilos. You know, if you're going to put a stethoscope on it, see if it's ticking or whatever you want to do with it, you've got to be at the bomb. Now, right, I'll just strip down the T-shirts and just sit, like, straddle the bomb.
You've got all that stuff we see in the films with a big helmet, big, yeah, like, suits and...
Wearing one of those suits isn't going to make a blind bit of difference. Like, 500, half a metric ton of explosives goes off. Wearing one of those suits, so you might as well be comfy.
Where do you have to go in your head to be able to stay calm in that position when you've got a live explosive in front of you?
Avoiding risk is not a strategy for success and survival, because whether you like it or not, something will crop up in your life. You need to be tooled up and ready for it.
Andy, welcome.
Thank you very much. Is it time to get serious now, is it?
Yeah.
Now that I've called this, we've got
serious
to watch what
mode.
We say.
Serious mode, yeah. No, appreciate you, mate. I know we've been back and forth a little bit to try and get the dates to marry up. You're a busy man, aren't you?
Yeah, mostly through my own, it's my own fault, you know, I suppose, self-generated stuff. But it's been all right this year so far, yeah.
You enjoy it. You enjoy that kind of fast pace.
Well, I think there's... And I'm not saying it's necessarily always a healthy attitude to take, but there's something I intuitively think, well, if I'm working hard, I must be doing okay. I'm doing the right thing. Like, I'm looking after my family. I'm successful in better comments, depending on how you want to define success. But I think, you know, from a work ethic point of view, you can be like, right, I'm driving from here to there. I've got this meeting. I've got that job. I've got that. I'm all over the place. I must be doing something right. I must be doing well. That said... As I get a bit older, fractionally wiser, started from a pretty low baseline, so it wasn't difficult. But, you know, you start to realise that, oh, hang on a second, you know, maybe you need to work smarter, not necessarily harder, and also, depending on how you define success, and I've got my own views on that, but maybe running around like a blue-ass fly isn't necessarily a good thing all the time, you know.
I mean, do you think that changes when you have a wife and have kids, right? Because if it was just you on your own,
yeah, you're right.
You wouldn't give a shit, would you?
No, yeah, because I'd be like, right, cool, I'm just doing what I enjoy doing. I've got almost no alternative. I may as well just crack on and get it done. So I think it gives you a reason. Also, it motivates me. Like, shock news, I quite like my wife.
We'll send
my kids.
This clip to her, yeah.
I quite like my kids, and I quite like my house. That's why I married her. That's why I bought the house. You know what I mean? So you know, I've been on jobs or whatever, exhibition, and you know, some folks are like, oh, great, you know, a couple of weeks away from the wife and kids. Thank God for that. And I'm like, what? Really? I really like being in my house with my wife and kids. Like, I genuinely enjoy it, especially. And you know, the more you're waiting, the more you appreciate and enjoy it. And I'm like, you're probably doing something wrong, mate. If you don't like your family or your house, maybe you want to...
Or with the wrong person.
Yeah, you might need to ask yourself a few questions. So yeah, it's you know what? Probably the best way for me to be is peaks and troughs. Like, if I can be away or on the road, whatever it is, for a concentrated period of, like, days, weeks, whatever it is, and then come back, I can take a few days off. I can, you know, to recharge, can hang out with the kids and enjoy it and not feel guilty. Mm-hmm. You know, because of the hard work and the being away, makes me feel like I deserve. I'm allowed to spend a bit of time at home with wife and kids and just chill.
Yeah, I mean, you're such an active guy. Do you get that guilt if you haven't trained in a day?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you train every day?
Most days. I mean, I do something physical every day, even just stretching. I've slightly changed recently because at one point I was like smashing out six sessions a week, like proper sessions, and actually I wasn't giving myself enough recovery time. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little bit older now, so things that ache a little bit more, take a little bit of time, more time to recover. So I'm trying to train a bit smarter, maybe not quite as hard. Mm. So there's a bit more movement and stretching on there, which I do every day, probably twice a day, actually. And I'm only hitting the gym like for a proper session, probably about four times a week. But then that fluctuates as well. If I'm sat at home for a week, I'll probably put some extra stuff in. But if I'm, you know, you're doing say do stunts on a Monday, but it depends what it is. But if you're doing like fairly physical stunts on a Monday, you know, cave diving Tuesday, skydiving Wednesday, then you might want to take Thursday, Friday off, because even though that's not training as such in the gym, it's still physical and you still need a bit of time to recover. And I say nowadays I need to be a bit more mindful of recovery time than perhaps I was 20 years ago.
It's so mad hearing you talk about like what you do on each day. Most people are like, yeah, I went to work and watched some Netflix. You're like skydiving one day, you know, cave whatever one day. It's just crazy.
Yeah, but I mean, and that's, it's all true. Like the forward facing of my life, you know, what you see on social media or what I'm talking about now, it's all true. But what's not there is the background stuff that is boring, mm-hmm. you know. So yeah, there has been weeks where I have done stunts one day, sky the next day, and cave the next day. That has happened. But it's not that all the time. And a lot of time, you know, I always said this, that if you did a bar graph of how I spend my time, the thing that would be vying for the top spot would either be sat behind a laptop or sat behind a steering wheel. And that's kind of the reality of it, because to get to the cave diving, you've got to do a lot of work for it. And to get the skydiving, you've got, you know, and even, well, maybe it's less with the stunt work. But even with stunt work, again, you know, we're not constantly crashing cars and you know, falling out of buildings, whatever it is. You spend a lot of time, days at a time, just stood around, just waiting for things. That it's a lot of the military in that. There's a number of crossovers I found between the military and stunts, and one of them is that, you know, it's like don't do a great deal for a lot of the time, and then suddenly it's on and it's high kind of pace, kind of high risk, and then that stops and you go home.
Yeah, mad. I mean, I'm looking at the research some of the team have done. I'm going to rattle these out for people so they can get a bit of background. 10 years in the British Forces as a paratrooper, diver and bomb disposal officer, elite diver, skydiver and wingsuiter, competing in speed skydiving, mountaineer and climber. You're a volunteer with a cliff and rope rescue team and cave rescue group. Currently studying a master's in archaeology.
Finished that now.
Insane. TV presenter. obviously a stunt performer on various projects, author and a member of the Mensa. I mean, when I reel that back out to you, do you think, fucking hell, I've lived a full life? Or do you think I need more?
I'm not sure I need more. I need a bit better. I mean, some of it, it's always good to put stuff in context. Because it sounds, I always think it sounds more impressive than it really is. Like if you know the reality behind the curtain. So like, I mean, being a member of Mensa, I joined that when I was 14. And I just haven't left. But when you do the test, it's all about your IQ based on your age as well. So if I took the test today, the chances are, you know, well, I certainly wouldn't do as well, because the chances are I'm no more intelligent now than I was 14. I'm much, much older, so it's not as impressive. The other thing is I slightly disagree how IQ tests are done, because it's for example, give me a bit of pub quiz trivia for people here, but say there's 100 questions in the test and you have 60 minutes to do it, okay? And you got to get, I don't know, say you got to get, whatever, 8%, it doesn't really matter. If you're not that intelligent, but your brain works very fast, you can answer all 100 questions in that time, okay? And then you might only get 60 right, so you'll score 60, right?
Got you.
But if you're really intelligent, but you know, your brain, you need to think about things, you might only be able to answer 50 questions. Now, you might all get all 50 correct, but you'll only score 50%. Hmm. So I've learned over the years, my brain works very fast. I don't think I'm actually, I genuinely, it's not being trying to be self, like humble, I think I'm not smart on everybody else, but I know my brain does work quite fast. I'm very good at those sort of tests, require speed answers. I score better than actually that is true, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So
that's interesting.
I don't, it's funny you bring that, like, I think it's from my website, your research has found that, but I never know I put that in, because it's not something I feel is, it is true, but it's not like representatively true.
Okay, devil's advocate, but you're doing a master's in archaeology, right?
Yeah.
Or you've completed that now.
Yeah, finished that, yeah.
But that requires, it's no easy feat studying anything, doing a master's in anything.
No, it was challenging actually, because that was during COVID. So during COVID, just to stop myself going kind of like mentally, I thought, all right, I'll do some studying. And so I did a bit of it before, so I was kind of like, quite interested in the subject. So I could have just read a book, but I thought, well, I'll have some structure to it, and hopefully there's a point to the end of it. But it wasn't easy. I've got to say, it wasn't like a sail through. It was a bit of a struggle. And just getting back to like being in education after a long, long, long time out was quite hard, how you've got to think of things differently. And but even the dissertation I had to write, I did it on cave diving archaeology. So cave diving as a as a tool for archaeology. So I slightly cheated because that was pretty easy for me. But I mean, for the for
something
the,
you enjoy as well.
For,
isn't it?
For people at the university who were marking it, for them, they were like, my God, this is really fresh, new material. And I was like, I could pretty much have written this with very little research because I kind of knew all. Anyway, so, you know, I don't know if it's quite as impressive as it sounds.
I mean, let's go back to the earliest to understand you a bit. I mean, what kind of childhood lead you to have so many passions and varied interests? Like, where did you grow up? Talk to me about those early years.
Yeah, so I grew up in the sort of northeast highlands of Scotland, kind of between Aberdeen and Inverness, what is now the Cairngorm National Park. So often how it's phrased, the question to me is like, oh, how did you get into the outdoors? Well, I didn't. I was born and brought up in the outdoors, so I didn't get into it. It was just that was, I didn't know. I mean, I think I'd visit the city till I was about 12, and it was Aberdeen, so it wasn't like it was London or New York. Nothing wrong with Aberdeen for my mates and my mum who are back there now.
Yeah.
And I'm sure listening to this podcast. My dad was a forester on a big estate up there. So we were just surrounded by trees and the lochs and rivers, and that was it. That was normal life, really.
We're quite a small place you grew up.
I mean, yeah, the house wasn't next to any other houses. So it was a big estate. So,
As in, did you mix with other people, or were you quite isolated to your own family, kind of thing?
No, well, we had, like, the local primary school, I think, had about 28 pupils, and that's of all, that's like ages, it was 5 to 11. That was like, you know, it's like a couple of people per year group in the primary school, like proper little highland school.
That is small, yeah.
You know, you'd get 3 or 4 weeks off every winter because the school would be shut down because the weather was that, you know, snow, like, used to properly snow back then, you know. In fact, there's a mate of my dad's whose kids would always come and stay with us a lot because he worked for the water board or the electricity board. But anyway, so he'd be in call-out all the time. So they used to come to stay at our house for nights at a time because he looked after them himself. The mother wasn't there anymore. But he'd be out in the road, you know, fixing, I think it was water board, fixing frozen pipes and that, you know. So that was normal up in the Highlands at that time.
Mm.
It was... You know, even in our house, again, playing my violin here, but it wasn't that big a deal. But in our bedroom in the winter, you'd have frost in the inside of the window.
Wow.
That was just standard, you know. You went to two duvets and, you know, you went to bed with a bully hat on. Saying it now, it sounds ridiculous, but honestly, this was what it was like back then.
But that sort of stuff we were talking off air, weren't you? That those kind of struggles, but to you, they probably weren't. They didn't feel like struggles at the time, right? Because they're just everyday life.
Yeah.
But that would have toughened you up for probably what you're doing now, yeah, or some of the other stuff you did in the military.
Yeah, well, think, as human beings, we all look through life through the kind of lens of relativity. We compare things to what's gone before. If whether your life's good or bad is compared to what you know is good or bad. You know, if you were born and brought up in a Somalian refugee camp, then, you know, living in a council estate in Birmingham is amazing, but if you were born and brought up, you know, in the sort of the gentry of the New York society, whatever that is, and you know, suddenly living in a nice semi-detached in Bristol is absolutely a nightmare. You know, so it's
bang on.
It's kind of depends. So what it gave me, say within, well, is a bit of perspective. Like, you know, what I think between that and also just things I still do now and what I did in the military, it gives you a degree of perspective, mm-hmm, on what is actually bad and what is actually hard. You know, I heard a good phrase. Jimmy Carr. Jimmy Carr's a really good podcast guest. He's a comedian. He's a super, like,
very good.
Yeah. Like, he's expected to be funny, and he's not that. Well, he is funny still, but
quite it's profound, isn't
it? Yes, it's philosophies in life, and like, Jesus Christ, amazing. But one of the things he said about, he was commenting on some people asking about woke society, he said, well, people now are saying that words are violence, but that's only ever said by people who've never experienced real violence. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely true. People go, oh, words are just as bad as, you know, as, you know, physical violence. No, it's not. I guarantee you. And the fact you think that means you've had a pretty good life up till now.
Yeah. I mean, that's the way the world's going now, isn't it? It's a bit...
I think it's swinging back.
Do you reckon?
Yeah, I think we peaked, I don't know, last year with that, and I think we're swinging back to a little bit more. Certainly in the UK, America, I think, are still polarising, but I think in the UK, we've gone through a couple of years of, like, slightly, I think, getting more and more and more extreme, ridiculous, and people are going to go, hang on a second. Like, the silent majority have gone, okay,
that's enough.
Enough's enough. It's a little bit of common sense, please.
Yeah. I know. I felt that in our industry as well. Just that sense of kind of like an identity crisis going on amongst a lot of the youth, I've noticed as well. Yeah. A lot of our younger kind of club goers or promoters and stuff. It's been interesting. I mean, you're involved in so many high adrenaline, like extreme disciplines. What was your relationship like with fear as a kid? I mean, you grew up in the outdoors, but
yeah,
was there anything you were like scared of, or you know?
No, I don't. My approach to being scared is no different to everybody else's. Like, I get scared of the same things and the same amounts as everybody else. I'm not a psychopath. I hope. Anyway,
you got some time yet to change that.
Would you know if you were? But no, I'm pretty confident. I'm not. And I'm also not an adrenaline junkie. I don't like adrenaline. I don't like being scared. I hate being scared. It's not nice. It's not a pleasant thing to do. I mean, it happens and you just got to take it in the chin, but I don't enjoy it.
That's quite interesting.
It's not like, so, yeah, so, and I, you know, especially when I do talks, I try and convince people. Aren't always convinced by the end of the talk, but I'm trying to convince them that this is true. So from the outside, you see cave diving and skydiving, whatever else. You're an adrenaline junkie, or you're fearless, or, you know, you've got a death wish. None of that's true, right? I'm probably the most paranoid and cautious person you're likely to meet. That's why I'm still alive and doing these things. And a lot of the approaches, some I learned as a kid and some actually like doing bomb disposal and high research. One of the things they teach you is like, you know, do an accurate threat assessment, like accurate risk assessment, basically. Mm-hmm. This is basically a health and safety podcast now.
Literally.
You know, and, you know, identify the risks and then do something about them. So to make the thing that seems dangerous from the kind of uninitiated looking from the outside actually acceptably safe. So, you know, things like skydiving, it's still great fun. It's still a buzz, don't get me wrong. But like something like cave diving, if I get to the water's edge and I'm scared, don't go in the water. Don't do it because something's wrong. That's not right. You shouldn't be scared before a cave dive.
Really?
That's a bad sign. You should be, yeah. Because you've identified. So in essence, how it works is this. This is my sort of approach. Cave diving is a really good example for this. Cave diving is a very binary sport or very binary activity in that no one gets injured cave diving, right? So it's climbing, skydiving, stunts, whatever else. You can twist an ankle. If you have a bad landing, you can break a leg, break your back, be in a coma, you can die. There's a graduation, increasing kind of outcome there. In cave diving, either it goes well, cool. It goes badly, but you fix it, cool. It goes badly, you don't fix it, and you're dead. I mean,
there's no in between.
No, there's not in between. Again, it sounds like I'm being really overdramatic, but I mean, cave diving is like that. It's very binary, you know.
I mean,
but if it's done properly, it's super safe. As long as you do it properly, and you might meet some of the like elite, like top world class cave divers, and most we're all geeks. There's no Red Bull drinking maniacs amongst us. You know, we're all like, you've got to study the physics and the physiology of what you're doing and you get into the kind of arse in the details. Otherwise, it's not going to go that well for you.
I mean, it frightens the hell out of me. But all I see is when you say cave diving, I just think of probably not the actual thing that you're talking about. I think of, you know, the caving that you see that people go down and crawl through these like little dark, without the oxygen, but they're crawling through these tiny little openings. It's fucking claustrophobic. And then they get stuck and you hear this story that someone's stuck and they've died upside down.
I mean, that I think that's one story of somebody stuck and died upside down.
You know which one I mean. It does the rounds every year.
But that's because it's a one-off anomaly. That's why it's kind of, it does the same. Like,
your one's more based in water, right?
Often you've got a cave to get to the dive site sometimes, which is a real bollock because dive kit always a ton. Sometimes you're diving through something that's incredibly tight. But if you can get in, you can get out. You know, people get stuck. It's like, well, I'm not sure how you manage that. Because normally, if you can get in, you can get out. You know, you can make an assessment as you push in. Okay, what's it looking like further on? And there's been a couple of cases where it's been fairly constricted, but you know, I've never really had a close call. I've only had one time underwater that I thought, shit, this is bad, but that was in the forces. In like deep diving, technical diving, cave diving, people often say, oh, well, you must have had some close calls. Nope, there's never been a time when I've been underwater. I said that one time in the forces where I thought, oh, I might die here. Never happens because of the stuff I've put in place before I got in the water to make sure, should anything go wrong, I've already got a plan A, B, C, D, and E ready to rock and roll.
Yeah, it's quite an important message there, isn't it, about preparation?
Absolutely.
most people just like, impulsively do stuff. No. Some of these extreme things, this is probably the kind of negative stories that you hear.
Yeah.
So-and-so's jumped out of a plane without ever doing it before, or so-and-so's jumped into...
Paranoia saves lives.
Mm.
That's all about. And when you do hear episodes of guys cave diving and dying, it's because of something they've done or not done. It's been user error, and it's often because people who have not been trained with the wrong kit. You're like, why the hell are you in there in the first place?
Mm.
It's like jumping out a plane without a parachute, or jumping out a plane with a parachute in your back, but having never had any training before in your life. It's like, well, you can't use that start to judge skydiving. You know,
does that kind of paranoia, and I worded it as that because you said obviously it helps you stay alive in these extreme things that you do. How does that translate into personal life in terms of being a father? Like, if your kids are out playing, are you that worrying, paranoid dad, or are you actually quite relaxed because you, do you see what I mean?
Yeah. I try the latter. I'm past the former, in that, like, I'm dead against helicopter parent and all that sort of stuff. Like, you need to let kids take risks, and sometimes they'll get injured, and that's cool. So, because if you think that, like, protecting them from the risks of the world and wrapping them in cotton wool is the best thing to do as a parent, then you're wrong. Because that's fine, and maybe you'll be able to protect them against the world for so long, but eventually, one day, they'll be out in the world on their own. And the bottom line is, and this goes for adults too, avoiding risk is not a strategy for success and survival, because whether you like it or not, something will crop up in your life. That's what happens in life. And it could be a bus around the corner, it could be another batch of COVID, and we're all locked down for you. Whatever it is, whether it's physical harm or mental harm or financial harm, but shit happens to you, no matter how much you try and avoid it. It is unavoidable. So assuming that's to be true, you need to be tooled up and ready for it. And if you spent your entire childhood, and indeed adulthood, avoiding risk or being sheltered from risk, then you will have no idea how to deal with it. So I've brought my kids out. They were lighting fires at the age of 4, and then one of them, nine-year-olds, he's whittling this, he's got a knife, and some people say, oh, you shouldn't be giving a nine-year-old knife. Why not? Well, it's dangerous. Nope. It's dangerous if I don't teach you how to use it.
Mm-hmm.
A four-year-old could light a fire. Like, is that a bit dangerous? Well, it would be if I didn't tell them the dangers involved in it and how to avoid those dangers and how to light a fire properly.
I love that.
Yeah, but so I try and get them out, as much as possible, and try and make them as independent as possible, and try and build that physical and mental resilience against the world. And it is nothing, they fall over or things happen. It's like, right, it's not a big deal, is it? No, it's not. That said, I'm being brutally honest, I think that this is all parents. I said to a mate of mine very recently who had his first kid, and I was like, well, mate, welcome to the club. I've been scared all the time, because you are. And the ability that allows me to see all the potential problems for a cave diver, a skydiver, which then allows me to plan accordingly, so that either they don't happen, or if they do happen, I've got a plan B, also allows me to see all the, my kid falling down the stairs, or, walking out in front of a bus. And so I try not to act in it, but I can't stop the paranoia when it comes to my kids.
Yeah, I don't know that feeling yet. I haven't had any children yet, but my mum and dad, I'm an only child. But my mom and dad had 15 brothers and sisters each. And they always say the same thing, 15. Even though, yeah, mate, in those years, in that time in Turkey, whatnot. But they always say, I'm 36, I'm taller than both of them, bigger than both of them, probably stronger, definitely stronger now. But to them, I'm still this fragile little boy that could fall over. It's really interesting. And I'm weirdly excited to get to that period of my life, to get to that chapter of my life, to kind of be responsible for another human. Properly responsible.
Yeah, it's a big change. So my kids are 7 and 9 now, and it is a change. But you look back, and my missus is more than I do. You look back in your time before you had kids, and you're going, what did we do with our time? like myself and missus, we're both in our respective set of disciplines, have achieved a lot more since having kids than we did with them. We were like, did we just sit around doing nothing all day? Like, how can we achieve so little?
Mm.
We had so much free time in our hands. We kind of squandered it a little bit, but. It definitely sort of focuses the mind on certain things.
For sure, yeah. What you were saying earlier reminded me of that quote. What was that quote? I'm going to butcher it now, but it's better to be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war.
Yeah.
About your sons and what you've taught them.
Yeah.
You'd rather them have all the skills and not have to use them.
Correct, yeah.
Than have none of the skills. And then when life slaps them around the face, because it does, it's done for you, it's done for me, it's done for everyone I know. At some point, you can avoid it for a bit, as you said. Then how do you react to that? How do you come back from that?
And also, by making them face certain challenges and, risks and what have you, and obstacles and hardships, it also can say it gives them perspective, mm-hmm. because sometimes life slaps you in the face, but it's not that hard. But unfortunately, some people, because they've never been slapped in the face before, think it's the end of the world. And you're like, so, you know, two people get slapped in the face with the same degree of force. One person shrugs it off and walks on. One person crumples to the ground. Why? Because the second person's never been slapped before, and the first person's been slapped loads of times. Being slapped in the face just isn't a big deal anymore. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
There's elements of that, that even some of the hardships or the problems we've faced and some of the traumas or whatever you want to call it in our lives can be very, very positive things later on.
Mm-hmm. It's just being able to see it, as you said, perspective, seeing it like that.
Yeah, and it's very hard in of the moment. There's been times when I've gone through stuff and then you look back and went, oh, I was quite lucky. It's the old, I can't remember when I first heard this. It's been made famous on social media by an interview with Shia LaBeouf, who, you know, I mean, he's had his problems, certainly.
Yeah.
But it was before that, but he's the one that's made it famous. The idea that this guy's got a farm and one of his horses dies and his son's like, oh my God, this is terrible. And the farmer says, well, you know, we'll see. And then his neighbor's like, oh, well, I've got extra horses, so I'll give you one of my horses. And they get this horse that's better than their old one. And the son's like, oh my God, that's amazing. It was so lucky. This is brilliant. And it was so lucky that the old one died. And his father says, well, you know, we'll see. And the son's out riding this new fast horse and he falls off it and breaks both his legs. His son's like, oh God, this is the end of the world. I can't help with the harvest. What are we going to do? This is terrible. His father says, well, you know, we'll see. And the army comes the next day to conscript people to take to the war, and they can't take the son because he's got two broken legs. So off they go, you know, leaving them, and, you know, disappointed, but that's fine. And the point goes on infinitely, but the point being is you never know how good or bad someone is, something is, until you've got a little bit of distance. And then say there's things that might have happened that's been massive, serious, like, stresses. And then maybe a year later, you're like, God, if that hadn't happened, then that and that wouldn't have happened, and I wouldn't have had this amazing thing happen. So, yeah.
I've been through a few of those kind of cycles in my life, and I'm probably going through one right now as well. But it's like...
What, right now, like in the podcast?
Yeah, right now. But in general, you're sort of like, you think, fucking hell, again, like, or like, this is wrong, that's wrong. But I know in 6 months, 12 months, 2 years, 5 years, I'll look back at this and I'll be able to draw that positive out of it. I'll be able to draw out of it.
In all things passing, and I think it's a Bruce Lee quote, but, you know, all things pass. Or it might be Gandalf. Anyway, what is it?
All things maybe Dumbledore, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember. But anyway, and again, I think with a perspective of age, I can look back, you know, and go, oh yeah, it does. Like, the good times pass, unfortunately, but so the bad times. So the thing to take from that is, like, right, if you're in a good time, enjoy it. It's not going to last, but enjoy it, appreciate it's great. And then, you know, there will be a dip to come in the future. But again, that will pass. And all you can try and hope for is that you try and score more highs than lows and that your lows aren't too low, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, things peak and drop.
So, like, let's touch back on this. So you grow up in the Highlands. Mm. How do you then end up, because it sounds like your dad didn't have the military background. What then makes you go into military? Right, is that's the next step?
So my dad's side of the family, apart from him, were all coal miners. Which there's not many coal mines in Scotland anymore. So actually, I can kind of vaguely remember when Thatcher shut them all down, and, you know, only because I can remember everyone had suddenly VHS players because they got the redundancy money and everyone bought VHS players. So that was, I thought everyone was mega rich because, you know, they'd be made redundant. It was cool. I was about under six at the time. And my mum's side were all sort of farm workers, and the way that me and my brother kind of were going to get out was to join the forces. And, you know, we as kids, typical boys, you know, you had machine guns, we made of sticks, and we had action men, and, you know, had commando comics and all that sort of stuff. And that's what we were going to go and do. And so he joined the army at 16 as a boy soldier. He's still in. He's a full colonel now.
He's still in.
Defence Attaché in Turkey.
No, my neck of the woods.
Based in Ankara.
Is he?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Keeping up and down to Istanbul, but he's based in Ankara, so I think that's where the embassy is in Ankara. Mm,
that's right.
Up north. But yeah, he's out there. Not quite
fluent. Can he speak any Turkish?
Oh, yeah. He's not fluent yet, but he's all right. I mean, yeah, he's not, he wouldn't, he said, because he speaks fluent, for like properly fluent French.
Okay.
So I actually spoke to him last week, and I was like, oh, how's your Turkey getting on? Turkish getting on? He says, oh, I'm not fluent yet, but I can get by, which for him means he's actually really, really good.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah. He's loving it. We need to go out and see him. But if we're going to go out and see him, I'll make some tips off you actually after this. But he said, right, don't come to Ankara because I'll take the kids out as well and the wife. He said, come to Istanbul and I'll come down and see you because Istanbul, he said, if you're going to give him a holiday, that's the place to hang out. Ankara's
it's incredible, Istanbul, yeah. Yeah. Ankara's, it's the capital. It's great. There's not loads to do there. Istanbul's amazing. The culture, the food, like the sights. It's wicked, mate.
Yeah, so we're going to go out and do that. Anyway, we've often travel military, podcast. Where were we? Yeah,
so your brother joined at 16.
Yeah, you know, he's my older brother, so and he would come back and he did basic training and all that. When he was 18, he went and a bit of time in Cyprus, a bit of time in Germany. He went down to Falklands in South Georgia. So as a kid, I'm like, this is amazing. This is the way ahead. And you know, had money in his back pocket. I mean, looking back now, you know, a private in the army was getting paid peanuts, but to us, it was like, you know, he bought a car. My guy's minted. This is amazing. You know, so I was like, right, that's the way I'm going to go. And I was speaking to the Forces Careers Office in Aberdeen because by that point, actually, myself, my brother, and my mum moved into Aberdeen when I was about 12. And the guy behind the desk was like, looking at my school results, and said, well, if you're my son with these results, I would say go to university, get a degree, and join as an officer. And I'm like, nah, that's not my thing. And it was a bit of reversed snobbery because I'm like, and I still suffer from this. I think a lot more people do than you think is a bit of imposter syndrome.
Yes.
Like I still don't think I'm that good at most. I'm always amazed when people want to come on podcasts or I'm doing talks. I'm like, really? I know on paper, I'm like, of course. Okay, the list you read out, I'm like, yes, I understand from an intelligent brain point of view. Yes, that makes sense, that list there. But like intuitive, I'm like, yeah, but really? I can't be right. So anyway, so he said, you know, and I was like, nah, people like me don't become officers. And, you know, to become an officer, you got to play polo with the Queen, you know, and have gone to Eton and that stuff. And my brother came home and he'd been at 20 years old. He was picked up from a private. And they said, we're going to send up a sergeant, so he's going to become an officer, like corps commission. And I'm like, what the hell? People ask, you know, don't become officers. He's like, no, it's changed. It's not what we thought it was. I mean, there is still parts of the army where you've got a second income and play polo with the Queen, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Or the King, I suppose it is now. I was going to make a joke then. I thought, no, I better not. I better take the mick at the Queen. You know, but most of the parts of the forces, you know, certainly most parts of the army, like the Royal Marines, couldn't give a monkey's where you came from. It would be a council estate in Aberdeen or, you know, the halls of Eton. They're like, are you good enough to do the job or not? That's all we care about. I decided to go to uni anyway, on the advice of some people who were already in the forces. And again, because I wasn't studying anything that was vocational, I wasn't going to be a doctor in the army or an engineer. I thought, well, I'll just do something I'm interested in. So I did zoology, a split degree of zoology and archaeology. Dead people and lions and sharks, basically, which is great because I had a great time at university. Like, I mean, I made the most of it. I enjoyed the study because I loved going to lectures and loved reading up and writing essays. Like, I liked the subject, you know, lions, sharks, cavemen, boom, awesome.
Yeah.
I also, you'll probably appreciate this as an events promoter and all that sort of stuff, that, you know, I enjoyed the social life of university very, very much, very much. But, you know, that was back in the day when from Scotland, I got a full grant. Mm-hmm. So I got all my tuition fees paid and I got £2,000, which basically got my rent paid for me. So I worked at a couple of bars, three bars. They got me food money and beer tokens. And that's all you need at uni, you know.
Yeah.
That's as long as you got, you know.
Beans on toast.
Yeah. And then, you know, pints are best because I went to Sheffield, so I was allowed to drink. That's why I drink. People go, why? So why do you drink bitter, not lager? Because unless you learned to drink in Sheffield, it was all bitter. And then you join the forces after that. I think I left. I actually did my final exam because I went early to uni. Did my final exam just before my 20th birthday.
So that is early, yeah.
I went just after I turned 17 to uni, and then did it in 3 years. So,
and you joined, and then you ended up as a paratrooper, right?
Paratrooper, not para-reg. So I spent most of my time at bomb disposal. So in 4-9, so 4-9 squadron is the para-commando and SF support squadron. So we've got three troops, and they did a bit of mix and matching, but we've got a paratroop. So a troop, we are all paratroopers, you know, maroon lids,
yeah.
Bomb disposal, high research. Another troop, again, bomb disposal, high research, commander training, a third troop who were mostly supporting the SF, mostly pool, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's what I spent most of my time doing. And then the diving side of it, I was an army diver, and the bomb disposal regiment from the army provides the army's underwater bomb disposal team. So the Navy have got much more teams than I have. We did because they've got, you know, the sea's a bit bigger than a river, but they take care of everything from the high water mark and below, and then the army take care of everything from high water mark and above. So rivers, lakes, and of course sewers. We did a sewer search in Basra at one point.
So I've got a school friend of mine now is in the Navy as a bomb disposal.
Mine cleaner style.
The terminology is, going to butcher it. But yeah, we went to school together and he's recently started doing that, and he said they're supporting SF quite a bit. All their fun jobs come from that, he said.
Yeah.
Otherwise it's boring.
Yeah, I think the MCD guys, mine cleaner divers, yeah, they'll be supporting the lads from pool for a lot.
Now, it says here that you've been on various amounts of tours, Iraq, Bosnia, Kosovo, Northern Ireland, Falklands, and bomb disposal in army, underwater bomb disposal team, airborne brigade, and maritime counter-terrorist group.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all very like mouthful, isn't it? It sounds like there's a lot going on there. Oh, but talk to me about this bomb disposal. And the reason I ask it is most of us would only know, say, what we've seen on like the Hurt Locker. But what's the reality of the job?
I've never seen the Hurt Locker. So I can't say, well,
has people referred it to you before?
Yeah. People keep asking me, well, what do you think of the Hurt Locker? And I'm like, I should probably watch it at some point. Probably it's a decent film, to be fair. So I don't know.
But, you know, what's the reality of that job? Because it sounds fucking mental.
Well, it peaks and troughs. So I was in Iraq, and actually I was running the teams. Seven teams. I think we'd five engineer teams, so SAPA teams, one RLC team, and one mixed team, so either RAF or Navy, because some of the Navy boys would come out and do, if you land, because the Navy mine cleaners divers are also trained how to do land, to do the land, and then they specialise, then do the underwater stuff, so they can operate on land as well. And they'd come out. So, and it peaked in trouble. So you might do next to nothing for weeks, you know, in which case you'd make yourself busy. So we used to go out and do like mine clearance on the Iran-Iraq border, or stuff that people would find, and like almost hearts and mind stuff. So not our direct remit, which is clearing IDs and all that stuff, but it was like, well, we're not doing anything for them right now. We know there's a load of old stuff from the 80s, from the Iran-Iraq war out there. We'll go and clear that, you know, to help the local community out. It wouldn't help us strategically, the forces, but will help local communities, hearts and minds, all goods. Why were they in the first place, supposedly? And then you'd sometimes have like these peaks of activity. Often if we'd as a sort of in the UK area, British area, if we'd shut down, like Basra would sort of shut down, we'd all sort of withdrawn into the bases. And we're out patrols for a few days. When you then went back out in patrol, what you'd find is there's loads of IDs, because we'd kind of left the ground open for people to come in and do bits and pieces. So then you might have two or three days of like, you just didn't sleep. You're out and about all the time. And that's when I would go out in the ground as well, because we're so short-handed. So, like a lot of the stuff in the forces, it's you sit around doing not a great deal, and suddenly it's like, you know, panic, right, go, and you're just on your feet for days on end. But the reality of a lot of it's what it's not is the red wire, blue wire thing.
It is
not that, right? That's not, if you're getting a pair of pliers out to cut red wires and green wires, then it's all get a bit serious. So there are various priorities that are given. So if someone's looking at a priority A, again, this is talking like almost 20 years ago, so the SOPs may have slightly changed, so I'm sort of being what they were, can't say what they are. That meant that effectively the commander of the area was like, I am willing to risk the life of my bomb disposal officer to get this done.
Wow.
You know, but they were super, super, super rare. And usually if you did that, you usually got a medal, right? So say, for example, it's a bridge. Right, the bridge is strategically essential. Right? So you cannot afford for that bridge to blow up. Right, so you're going to send somebody out on the bridge to defuse all the bombs and all that bits and pieces, and you're going to cut wires and whatever needs to do. Right. However, if that bridge is just a bridge and no one gives a monkey's about, how you do is, as a bomb disposal officer, you toddle up to it, you put a little charge next to one of the things, you back off and you blow the whole thing up. You're not a bridge. But so the but that's what you'd normally do. So normally what you do is you blow in situ, right? It was super safe. So we used to have mortars and rockets and that all the time being fired at the bases, and they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't go off properly. So you'd have this like angry semi-live, you know, or a mortar that had hit the deck and hadn't gone off, but it's like still full of explosives. So you wouldn't be there trying to screw the cap off and that with your hand, you know, swept it in your face. You'd walk up to it, you know, pop a little charge next to it, surround it with sandbags to minimise the sort of blast, and you'd back off behind the Land Rover and blow it. And then you'd wander back up and shovel the debris.
Controlled explosion.
Yeah, controlled explosion, because that's super safe. Because again, with bombing, this is what come back to you about, you know, paranoia saves lives, and how doing threat risk assessments and threat assessments is so important in what I do now, why I'm not bad at it, because that's what I was taught. You look and go, right, first things first, what's the safest way to deal with it? Blow it, get everybody out of the way and blow it in situ. Cool. Can you do that? Yes. Well, do that then.
Got you.
Don't make it needlessly dangerous. It doesn't have to be. So yeah, most of the time it's that. It's actually quite safe.
Have you been in a situation where it's been like a wire cutting, like drip sweat dripping down your head, where you're thinking, fuck, if I do the wrong thing here, I'm gone.
They're very, very rare.
Are they? Yeah.
I think it happens.
I was trying to get my head around, like, where do you have to go in your head to be able to stay calm in that position when you've got a live explosive in front of you?
I've not done that as such, but I've done stuff when you've been, your first approach, you don't know what you've got. And as well as that, so once you get IDs, so improvised explosive devices, like booby traps, I suppose, would be the, they would often put, not often, sometimes put other IDs, which were hidden, designed to take out the bomb disposal officer.
Wow.
So that's always in the back of your mind. But the thing you do, and this is not me saying this, I spoke to mates of mine and other guys who have been in more recently. So this is not a me thing, this is an us thing. The long walks, you leave the cordon area and you've got a sort of like a no-go zone around the device, right? And no one's allowed to enter that area apart from the bomb disposal officer, okay? So that you walk from the sort of safe area into the cordoned off area, and then you're on your own, you walk down the device. But before you've entered that cordon area, it's so chaotic. Like you're on the phone to the air marshal, like the guy in charge of the airspace for the whole of, you know, Bas, the whole of the UK area, right? And you might be a sergeant or a young lieutenant, whatever it is, but you're pretty low down the pecking order. But you're telling him, I want a no-fly zone over this area of X hundreds of meters, and I want it in now. You're talking to the major, the colonel who's in charge of the infantry, who's cordoned off this light infantry. Right, I want you guys there, keep it at this area. You're in charge. You're the man in charge, or woman in charge of that thing. You're telling everybody what to do, right? You get your team, right, guys? Get your binos out. Right, it looks like this is a way to prep that, and that. Get that ready, and then if I need it later on, get that and that sorted out for the time I get back from my first, you know, first look, but I'll take this and this with me. All that's going, you're on two or three nets, or like nets, like radio channels. You don't take any comms kit in with you into the no-go zone, the cordoned off zone, right? Because you don't want any like radio waves, electrical interference. So that's all going on. Right, I'm going to go. And you step into that area and you're like, oh, thank fuck for that. And it is so peaceful and relaxing because now there's just you. And that's it. And this little bubble, this little universe you've got around you, nothing else matters. And most of the guys who have said this, we all say this, like the walk down to the device was actually quite zen.
Really?
Like, yeah, because all this chaos and like you're talking to people, all these net, these radio channels going and people talking, you asking you questions, you're prepping a kit, and you sit and you go, silence. Cool. And now I'm walking to no one else's agenda but mine. Just wander down there and do my own thing. Another guy, half jokingly, but he's very right, he said another problem disposal guy, he said, well, thing is, as far as you're concerned, everything is always going well.
Yeah,
because
at
the point it doesn't go well, you're not going to know about it.
Very true.
So he's like, well, as far as you're concerned, everything's always going well. I was like, that's a fair point, mate.
Very good mindset to have. And you're what are you wearing kit-wise? You got all like the stuff we see in the films?
Yeah.
With a big helmet, big like suits and...
They're pretty... it depends on the situation. They can be useful, but I mean, like, Iraq and Afghan, it's super, super hot. And you've got to get, again, there's a balance in that there. At what point does this safety gear start inhibiting your movement, your dexterity, your concentration? So it becomes actually the dangers now outweigh the safety that it brings. You know, that's always that thing. It's a bit like skydiving, you jump with two parachutes, right? You've got a main of safety. What if your main doesn't work? Get rid of it, pull your reserve. Cool, if that doesn't work, all right, well, I mean, you could carry a third parachute. Or whether that's what, or you could carry a fourth. You know, there's a point where you can't carry 20 parachutes, and you know. So that was some other times, you know, if it was like, oh, it's a grenade or a mortar, no one's touched it. I could just wander up there, put a little charge next to it, back off and blow it and sit shoot. You wouldn't bother getting engaged. Wander up there, drop it and come back, right? It's fine. And then also, like in London, for example, we used to get calls always on a Friday, I'll tell you one in a minute.
4 p.m. on a Friday.
Jen, about with the old World War II, German dropped munitions, right? So, like 500 pound, 1,000 pound German bombs dropped in the 1940s. Like, so whenever there's any work going on in London, you're like, okay, waiting for the call, like Canary Wharf for White City and all that renovation was going on. And always on a Friday afternoon, because what would happen, right? No one would want to admit to it, but they dig this thing up on like a Wednesday, and the foreman's like, well, we're not stopping working. You just need to put it to one side. And then on a Friday, they'd put it back, they'd dig a hole and put it back at the bottom of the hole. And you'd rock up there and you'd be like, all right, fellas, yeah, yeah. So you, when you think, oh, we just dug it up. We just dug it up now. Yeah, yeah. So how come it's like sat at the bottom, like nicely? It's not half buried, it's like completely excavated, just sitting nicely at the bottom of this trench, like that. All right, fellas. You're like, look, guys, I don't give a monkeys, right? It's done. What's done is done. I just need to know the truth so I can work out, you know, did you knock it? Where did you knock? Where did you find it? Just to give me a better idea what I'm dealing with. Anyway, point B is the boys, you've got like a 1,000-pound bomb, right? So that's 500 kilos-ish for those who want to run the metric system. If you're going to deal with that, if you're going to try and, you know, if you're going to put a stethoscope on it, see if it's ticking or whatever you want to do with it, put a clock stopper in like a big magnet, you've got to be at the bomb. Now, if that's a 500 kilograms of explosive, if it goes off...
What are we talking?
Well, you're not... Wearing one of those suits isn't going to make a blind bit of difference. Like 500, half a metric ton of explosives goes off, wearing one of those suits, so you might as well be comfy. So often the boys would be like, right, I'll just strip down their T-shirts and you know, and combats and boots and just sit, like straddle the bomb, like a cowboy, and then we lean over the front, like, dealing with the fuse in the nose. Because you're like, well, you know, and you'd sometimes the police would be there and they'd be like, why haven't you got any of the stuff on? And you'd be like, well, because why is he not wearing all the armour? Well, because he's on 500 kilograms of explosives. He might as well be comfy because it's, you know, all that body armour.
So
gonna,
wild.
Yeah,
to
not
me.
Going to help any more than his squadron issue T-shirt is.
That sounds so wild. I'm sure it will to other people listening. Straddling a bomb with just a T-shirt on.
Well, but it was... I mean, it does probably seem ridiculous from the outside, but from the inside, it's like, yeah, that makes complete sense because you've got to go and deal with it. So you can either run, being all kind of scrunched up, awkward, you might as well be comfy. You just sit in the bomb because if it goes off, whether you were stood beside it or sat on it, isn't going to make a blind bit of difference.
I mean, that's a large explosive, isn't it?
What massive. Kind of,
that'll take down a block.
Oh God, yeah, like the glass. So. I think, now again, I'm trying to speak from memory here. So PALM 4, which was the demo PALM, gives all these pamphlet, the sort of the manual for demolitions in the army, gives details of blast radiuses. And we used that to ask for coordinates for the police. So you go in and say, right, oh, I need a 2 kilometre exclusion zone around this bomb.
Wow.
And they'd be like, no, this is London. You go, cool, I've asked for it. You said no, I've done my job. So, you know, that's cool. I'm covered. Cheers, fellas. I'm going to crack on and do the job. You know, they might give you 200 metres, but I mean, and yeah, in London, if you're trying to clear like a 2 kilometre diameter, you know, that's, I don't know what that would be, but anyway. So you
takes an hour to drive a kilometre.
Well, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So there was sort of stipulated safety distances that would give you like, what would damage the buildings, what would damage glass, obviously glass, you know, would blow for a lot longer and all that sort of stuff. But how it's mostly done is, like depending on the nature of the device and what you found, but you could stick a clock stopper on there, which was an old, like a big magnet to stop any mechanisms working. And you could fill the fuse with salt water as well. Because we used World War II techniques. So the techniques we used in World War II bombs were exactly the same as the guys used in the 1940s. Nothing changed. We're still basically drilling holes in the fuses and pumping it full of salt water, letting those salt crystals dry and then lock up all the gear while we put a big magnet on it to stop it temporarily. That's what we did in 1940. That's what we're still doing today.
Wow.
Because that's the technology such that, like, well, the...
So bomb making hasn't come along that far, has it?
Not really. I mean, electronics, but apart from that...
As in, like, to actually diffuse it, yeah.
But that was like a mechanical device. And then you'd load it at the back of a wagon and you'd drive it through, you drive it out through London, and then you get to, like, one of the Dems ranges and again, blow it in situ.
Got you. Wow. Is there one story that sticks in your head from one of these jobs you've done in one of these countries that has stayed with you since, or not really?
I mean, I think, I mean, it's not something that I can't talk about, because the thing about the bomb, it's the bomb disposal stuff. It was certainly, from an ethical point of view, always good. Like, I've learned over the years to be very wary of journalists. I've been stung a few times, but I mean, one tried to catch me out with, like, about, oh, I've been a soldier in Iraq. Oh, should we have been in Iraq? And it's like, I don't know. But all I know was I was there and I was only doing good, because I was clearing either IDs or the team, the people who I was there with, were clearing IDs or were clearing munitions or were clearing mines. So that's good for everybody.
How can that negatively affect the only people
that's hurting is the guys trying to blow people up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. So you can't, from an ethical point of view, I'm good. And it's one of the good things about bomb disposal is that, from an ethical standpoint, it's pretty hard to judge you.
Do you struggle with that, though? Surely, taking the jobs you guys do, you can't have that, you can't think like that. Do you know what I mean? You can't. You kind of have to be desensitized a little bit.
Yeah,
for you to be able to do your job.
There's definitely a degree of compartmentalization. Although, rightly or wrongly, certainly the time was the forces, I believe, were the good guys. Mm-hmm. And I think, looking back, I still do now. Again, you talk about the politics, but we were trying to do good there. Like Bosnia and Kosovo, we had a very good reputation in the British as peacekeepers, as mm-hmm. mediators. And that's not necessarily because, like, oh, the British Army is the best in the world or any of that sort of rubbish. It's because we had spent 30 years in Northern Ireland making mistakes. So we'd learnt a lot about peacekeeping from Northern Ireland and hearts and minds operations and how to treat and talk to people. So we went to Bosnia and Kosovo. We were often brought into other people's areas to deal with problems, because the British forces had a very good reputation in the Balkans for being very good peacekeepers. But as I say, that's because
I always think, like, whenever we make a decision in life, not necessarily from the military, but as a dad, as a person, as a friend, at the point you make that decision, with all the answers available to you, you believe wholeheartedly, unless you're a shithouse, that you made the right decision.
Yeah.
By everyone. It's easy to look back in 10 years and go, fuck, actually, I probably missed that. I could have done this.
Oh, God, yeah.
You can't live like that all the time. I mean, you just got to let it go, haven't you, after a while?
But yeah, I've done it so many times. And sometimes, hopefully, unintentionally, like when you're doing what you think is absolutely the best, and then you look back and go, how the hell did I get so wrong? I misjudged that so badly. So I think it's one of the things I've learned to do is judge people's intentions.
Yeah.
Because if they meant well and they fucked it, it's like, all right, you're an idiot, but you're not a bad person.
Intentions and actions as well, right? Because we can all say the right things at the right time.
Oh, yeah, talk is cheap. I've got no interest in, like, don't tell me what you'll do, show me, I definitely judge people by their actions based on their intentions, but yeah, like, it's easy. I could tell you right now, I can fly. Right? Okay. No fly. See, it's very, very hard to lie with actions.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think you are what your actions are. I hope you are to a certain extent. Because, there's been times when I have instinctively not wanted to do something, but I've gone, well, that's not the person I want to be. So I'm going to go and do that thing. Like, I don't know, say, God knows, an old woman in the tube struggling with a bag down the stairs. Instinctively, I think, not my problem, I can't be arsed. But then I think, yeah, and you're a dick. So try not to be that dick. So go and help her. So you go and help her downstairs with her bag, right?
Which is
the right thing to do. Now, I would love to be the person that instinctively always wants to do the right thing, but I am not, right? But then you think, well, if I'm judged purely on my actions and not my, inner narrative, then I'm a good person, I've done the right thing. You still beat yourself up for, well, why wasn't I instinctively a good person? But, I think that for me, I hope I'm only judged on my actions, because some of the internal thoughts are less shiny white.
I think a lot of us go through that struggle. I was saying to a friend of mine the other morning after a run, I said, like, imagine if all our thoughts were projected or, like, written on our forehead. Well, most of us would probably be in jail, because it gets quite dark in there, doesn't it? It gets a bit weird in there sometimes.
Yeah. I have no friends, fewer friends even than I do now, but yeah,
it's like a comedy sketch. Your brain says one thing and a nice, calm thing comes out your mouth.
It's self-policing. Like, you've just got to the level of self-policing. It's when you go, you've got to think, like, am I being a dick? That's the best question you'd have, is, like, stop. Before I say anything, am I being a dick? And you know, but even I get rocks, I go, nope, nope, this is the right thing to do. And then afterwards, you're like, oh no, I was a dick. Missed it again. So
I always try and think, like, if I'm about to say something that's a little bit, how would I feel if they said it to me? If I, you know, quickly, very, very quickly, and I think, like, yeah, probably would wind me up. So I'm not going to say it to them.
Unless they deserve it.
Yeah, well, sometimes they do.
Hi, guys. While I've got you, I wanted to announce an exciting new sponsor for the show. For those that know me or listen regularly, you'll know that I'm a big combat sports fan, and some of my favourite kit to use when training is by a brand called Venom. Fellow combat sports fans will know Venom as the UFC's official outfitting apparel partner. They have clothing and equipment for MMA, boxing, Muay Thai, and BJJ. However, what I'm most excited about is their new lifestyle range, some of which I'll be rocking on the show. It's a privilege to partner with a global brand such as Venom. Will it make me a better athlete? Probably not. But at least I'll look good doing it.
What made you leave the military?
It was either that or prison. No, I'm joking. So I got to a point where I was very lucky, again, with doing bomb disposal and all that bits and pieces and being part of 4-9 especially, that I had sort of sidestepped promotion for quite a long time and stayed in the coal face. So, you know, I got to go and do, I was still as a sort of senior captain, still like fast roping out of helicopters on oil rigs with, you know, supporting the guys from pool and, you know, going on operations, getting out in the ground and doing stuff. And most of my peer group were like, you know, 2 ICs and they were flying desks, you know, by that point. So I was super lucky. But it got to the point where in the forces, you get to a certain rank and age and inevitably you're going to be behind a desk. And it's like 30-ish, and you know.
It's not age, really, is it?
Not at all. Look, no, not at all. 30 is like old. And it doesn't matter whether you're a senior NCO or an officer, it doesn't matter like that. You start becoming either a warrant officer or you're becoming a captain or mate, a major. And I was like, this is not why I joined the army for. And the forces in general tend to hemorrhage guys at about 30, 32 because most people didn't want me. That's fine. And I couldn't forever stay in the job I was in because you've got to meet, you know, room for the guy beneath you. But I loved it. Like I was on the pager for the London stuff, which I didn't hold that often, was 30 minutes notice to move. The Airborne Task Force was 24 hours notice to move. The MCT page, the Maritime Characters page, the supporting the guys from pool, was a 3 hours notice to move page. And I started on that 3 hours notice to move page for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. Absolutely loved it. You know, leave is for the week. Who needs leave? I've got a pager. I'm cool. Like I'm, you know, this is awesome. So yeah, I left. And actually when I left the guys from Glasgow, Glasgow's the Manning division up there, came down to interview me. Initially like, we'll give you a year at a train regiment, nice 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, dead easy, dead predictable, a bit of stability because we know you've been doing all this stuff, you know, been on this pager for how long. I was like, No, didn't you read my letter of resignation? Like, I'm not resigning because I've been doing this stuff for years. I can't keep doing it, you know? I want to keep doing this stuff. So people say to me now, do you miss it? I miss what I was doing. I don't miss what I would have been doing had I stayed in. So I don't regret leaving.
Okay.
Because I would have been behind a desk. And that's cool for some people. I've got, like, my best mate in the forces is still in. He's a bloody brigadier now.
Wow.
Yeah, working at Whitehall. No idea what he's up to, but... but, you know...
It's interesting.
Yeah, but so he was made for him. He was always going to do really well, be a commanding officer and you know and fly. And I was like, yeah, you know, I was always. I don't regret joining as an officer, but I think I was always a bit like, oh, I'm not sure that I should be here. You know, a bit of that, and I think I'd have been happy. In some ways, would have been happier out in the ground a bit more, doing a bit more stuff on the coal face. Because even out in Iraq, you know, doing more disposal, you know, I did some, but with the 7 teams, and they were doing the bulk of the work that I was kind of looking after and command and control and occasionally assisting, that sort of stuff. So, I was like, right, I'm gonna leave and I'm gonna go and, well, what I thought was that, all right, I'll be the next Ranulf Fiennes meets Jacques Cousteau. How hard can that be? You know what I mean? It's just piece of piss.
Yeah.
So I left, and what I learned very quickly is it turns out, and this will probably come as a shock to you, people won't just give you money to go and have fun. Who knew? Who knew? So it's like, oh Christ. So what I did realise quite early on is that people won't, you know, pay to go into expeditions, but they will pay to communicate these things once you come back. So things like, back when magazines were big, this is almost pre-internet now, this is like 2008, 2009, mm-hmm. So again, we spoke earlier on before we're on the podcast about, you know, work ethic and you kind of your approach to life. And I was like, right, no one owes me a living. So I'm not going to go knock on doors and ask to write for magazines. I'll go and I'll get an idea. I'll think the idea. I'll go and do it. I'll take the photographs. I'll come back. I'll write the article. Then I'll go and knock on doors so that I'm like, I'm not going to tell you what I will do. I'm going to tell you what I've done. Luckily, if the first door I knocked on was like, it's actually it's gone now, a dive, it's called Dive Magazine. It was like the biggest dive magazine in the UK. And I'd done this thing and the editor was still a friend of mine. He's like, great, awesome. Yeah, we'll buy it off you. It was decent money back then. Much, much more money you can get paid now for a magazine article. And he was like, right, great. And what are you going to do next? I was like, Christ, okay, great. And that's when I learned I could write. Like, a bit of academics, but then the forces. But it turns out I found writing very easy.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing more and more articles, stuff for outdoor camping, climbing stuff, eventually skydiving. And then I started doing talks, again, mostly dive shows, outdoor shows, that sort of stuff. And then that attracted a little bit of sponsorship. But at the same time, to pay for all these projects that I could write and talk about, I was doing the old X-Forces work. So it was...
close protection?
Yeah, bits and pieces. Like, I'd worked in Control Risk Group for a while. Mm-hmm. Had a Control Risk Group. So I worked out in Islamabad in Pakistan for about a year and then did the Nigerian Delta for about a year and a half on and off. Less close protection, more kind of intelligence gathering. And I found that far more interesting. I did a bit of CP work as well, but like in the UK and Europe and in the Middle East. But the stuff for CRG was a bit more... cerebral. It's quite mm-hmm. enjoyable. I did quite a few surveillance stuff in the UK. I worked with a couple of teams doing like longer surveillance jobs. They were super interesting.
Really?
Yeah, really
James
interesting.
James Bond shit, is it?
Nah. not that.
But not as cool as that.
A lot of sitting in the back of a car. I ended up just becoming effectively the 2IC of both those teams, only because I didn't mind write the reports. And so everybody would come in and give them all their photographs and reports and that, and then I'd collate it into a doc. But I used to really enjoy it because it means at the end of the evening, I'd be getting everybody's bits and pieces in because we'd like six or eight of us working on it. And that's where you can start joining the dots because you can't really join the dots until you've seen all the dots. So mm-hmm. I'd be like, this is, so I'd produce these reports and you start drawing conclusions. I found it really interesting working out both operations against kind of organised crime things, and one in, well, it was kind of Manchester area and then one in Liverpool area. And
two hot spots.
Yeah, but really interesting stuff. But anyway, so that was what's funding, because although I was going doing these things and getting paid to write articles or do talks, that money was not covering how much it was costing me to do the thing, you know. And then I started making little films. Well, I just did little video clips to use in talks, because sometimes a little bit of video footage explained better than a photograph. And this is pre-GoPro, so I'm still putting a little tiny tape, like DV tape, inside a camcorder.
Wow, yeah. I remember.
2000. In fact, I think, and then I made a film, I think the first sort of film that I sold to the BBC was called The Cave Diving, the Cave of Skulls up in Scotland. And I think I had a GoPro 1 that was like, in fact, it was just called the GoPro at that point.
Because I've had one of those.
Yeah.
The first one I had.
With
no screen on it, nothing.
Oh, God, no. I probably did, I don't know. It was SD, I don't know, but it was.
Cave of Skulls?
Yes.
Was there loads of dead people in there?
No, it was called the Cave of Skulls because they found, I think they found a bear or a wolf skull in there. Like an old, prehistoric bear or wolf skull in there from when they first started exploring it in the 70s. But section of it hadn't been explored. It's underwater section that hadn't been explored. So I went and self-filmed. I got a friend of mine filmed at the top, and then inside the cave I was self-filming, mostly on a GoPro 1.
In an area that hadn't been explored before?
Yeah.
That's crazy as well.
And we managed to sell it to the BBC for a programme called The Adventure Show, which no one have heard of because it was only shown on BBC Two in Scotland. So literally about 7 people watched it. But nevertheless, it's like, I think I could pay like £300 for it. God knows what it cost me to make. But anyway, point was, like, oh, cool. And then at the same time, I was doing a lot more kind of support work, safety work for BBC. So I was living in Bristol by that point. I'd left the forces and lived in Bristol, which is where a lot of the natural history units and the sort of adventure media people are based. So I was doing like diving safety, mm-hmm. skydiving stuff, climbing safety, all that sort of for those shoots.
The skydiving stuff, Obviously, I said to you before, I just done my first one a couple of weeks ago.
Welcome.
Welcome to the club, yeah. What a complete sensory overload, by the way.
Yes.
Fucking hell.
Yes.
Like, the lads obviously all told me, look, you won't remember, you won't notice, you won't see anything. Yeah. The first one's just what the hell's going on, and you're on the floor.
Yeah.
And I said to you before, like, I'm a bit claustrophobic. I don't really like flying. I don't like heights. So, like, it's all the things that I struggle with.
In one, right?
Yeah. And even from getting on this plane, the whole thing, like being strapped to someone, I felt a little bit restricted.
Yeah.
Then getting on a plane and sitting on the floor. It's no business class, is it?
No.
And then you're in this field, in this propeller plane that, like, Pablo Escobar delivered drugs in.
Probably did, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those sort of old things. Bumping around, trying to take off. And I remember we're flying up, and I paid for the extra package, so there's GoPro everywhere, and there's a winged guy from the Red Devils stunt team that was filming me.
Yeah.
He had, like, a wingsuit on. And I remember we're going up, and there's three of us doing it for Dorset Mind. And we looked out the window, and it felt fucking high. And I remember saying to the guy, how high are we? And he went, 1,000 feet. And we jumped from 15,000.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I noticed is, and you might know why this happens, from like 0 to 5,000, I felt high, and I felt height, you know, my fear of heights were kicking in. After about 5,000, I couldn't really comprehend the height, and that fear went. It's almost, you're too high, aren't you? And your brain can't work out.
Yeah, I think it's a bit like looking at a Google map, you know. I think the human brain, because I've noticed that this is not, I don't know why it happens. This is my personal theory. I think the human brain has a maximum capacity to sort of, you know, comprehend height.
Mm-hmm.
Because we as cavemen, we're not far out of the cave. We're still effectively animals. So you'd look over a cliff edge. Now, you don't find cliff edges that are 15,000 feet high. You might find mountains, but they're like slopes, an actual direct drop, like a vertical drop. So the ability to comprehend height at those sort of is pointless.
Mm.
It's not something we need, so what's the point? So yeah, I do find people say, I wouldn't want to skydive because I'm scared of heights, and I'm like, it won't matter. Do you get scared looking at the plane window when you're flying a holiday? No, I don't. Same thing. Same thing. You're right, see, it's scary for the first bit, but you get to a certain height and it's different for everybody. And then it's kind of like, oh, this is an abstract concept now.
It's bizarre, isn't it?
This is no longer high. This is just abstract to me.
So anyway, we got up to 15,000, which is the highest I think I could jump in the UK or whatever as tandem. And you sort of, you're at the top, and then the person in front of me went, I think I was second now.
Yeah.
Obviously, they opened the door, my ears popped.
Yeah.
And I'm like, fuck, this is actually happening. Like, I can't turn back now. But what do I do? I'm just going to... And you know, in my head, I go to this funny place. I was like, if this is the way you die, Ty, then so be it. Like, if this is what is written for you, then so be it. In my head, I was literally going to those places. I was thinking, if this is how you go, then just fucking enjoy it. Who cares? And obviously, then the guy goes, put your head back, you jump. The first... whatever it is, 1 to 3, 1 to 5 seconds when you're tumbling before he taps you so you can put your arms out.
Yeah.
That, for me, felt like what I thought the whole skydive would feel like. You know, your stomach going up into your throat as if you've like... And after that, once he tapped you and your sort of arms are out, you don't feel like you're falling anymore. Just loud wind. And then I think, weirdly, I struggled to breathe a little bit.
Okay.
There, but I think it was more the fact that I've done a bit of research after. I was probably holding my breath, if anything, out of fear. And then when the parachute went up, obviously it goes really peaceful. Little bit of motion sickness there on that parachute bit.
Yeah. So a few things you said there is that, so everyone finds that once you've reached terminal velocity, you're no longer accelerating. So in a car, you imagine being in a car, right? You floor it. You floor up to 100 mile an hour, right? You force back in your seat. You get to 100 mile an hour. If you maintain that 100 miles an hour, doesn't feel like anything.
Mm.
You don't continue to feel you're doing 100 miles an hour. You know, you get there, then you're just cruising along 100 miles an hour. It's the same with skydiving. And the motion sickness thing, again, a lot of people feel sick under canopy when you're a tandem passenger.
Got you.
Like, no one feels motion sickness under a canopy, under a parachute, if they are the ones controlling the toggles. No
same
one.
As the driver and the passenger, it's like exactly, braking, yeah.
You always say this, like, if you're feeling car sick, best thing you can do, drive. The driver never gets car sick.
Mm.
I've never heard of anyone getting car sick whilst driving. So yeah, that's why that happens. It's pretty common.
I mean, but the whole thing, as I said in the beginning, sensory overload. Like, the guy was like, look, there's Stonehenge, there's this, but like, I remember him saying it, but I don't recall seeing any of it. I don't recall even looking out to the globe or seeing anything, if you know what I mean. Next thing I know, he's like, right, remember that position, legs up, we've landed on the floor. And I'm like, what the fuck just happened? But with that said, and with all the fear of it kind of doing it, I probably will do it one more time, maybe when I'm in Dubai next, just as a little bit of a different scenery. Yes, now, it says here that you've jumped out from over 28,000 feet.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
How can you jump that high?
You've got supplementary oxygen onto it. It was a hey-ho jump in over the Arizona desert, so in Eloy in the Arizona. So you jump out, you've got the old sort of fighter pilot, almost like helmet on with a face mask, and then you've got a bottle of O2, bottle of oxygen strapped to you. And then you lob out, and this is a hey-ho, so high altitude, high opening. So you basically leave the aircraft and what we call hop and pop. You jump out and immediately pull your parachute. So you're under a canopy by like 27,000 feet. And then you have a long canopy ride back down, like I think it took me maybe 45 minutes to get back down to the
deck. It's quite long, isn't it?
Yeah. So, and that's why you need oxygen. So like 15,000 feet where you jump from, it's quite low oxygen, but you can afford to be up there for a few minutes and you're okay. If you're going to spend like half an hour at that altitude, you'd have to have supplement your oxygen. So at that height, you need oxygen to get up there. And then because I was quite a long time up in those higher altitudes, because I was under canopy and coming down on free fall, then I had to have quite a bit of supplementary oxygen. But yeah.
Mad. It feel really cold up there as well then? Yeah. I think it was -5 when we jumped where we were.
I was Dubai. It was one of the difference. It was +40 degrees Celsius on the deck because of the Arizona desert. I think in October it was. It was all about, it was -16 altitude. It wasn't too bad,
but the difference is big.
Yeah. So you had to wear. I mean, so the trick there was I wore gloves, obviously, but you didn't want them too thick so you could still reach your handles to pull. So what it is, once you sort your canopy out, you stick your hands behind your back, between your back and your container, like the backpack that the parachute's in, and you just steer with your harness. You do you just tilt your hips and your leg loops. You basically put different sort of weight into different leg, either left or right leg loop, and that can adjust. I can steer your canopy for you.
Until you're done. How many jumps have you done?
Just over 1,500. No, sorry, just under 1,500.
Fuck.
But again. So that sounds mega, but my two mates that I'm doing a lot of skiing at the moment, one's done like 6,000, one's done 10,000. So again, everything's relative.
They must be jumping every weekend.
Well, those two boys are full-time professionals. Like one of the guys, he's in his 40s now, his dad was a big skydiver. So he, as all he's done his entire life since like 18 years old, he's been a professional. He's been a skydive coach, a skydive instructor his entire life. Yeah. You know, he does everything, teaches, and he's been world champion a few times as well and that sort of stuff. So, you know, he spent his entire life, both working and recreational life, skydiving. That's all he's done.
Mad.
Yeah.
Any hairy moments for you?
I've been pretty fortunate. I mean, now and again. So I've had a few. I've never. So right, it's nothing. I've never chopped. So I've never cut away my mane.
Really?
Yeah. I jump a fairly large canopy in a 7-cell. So a 7-cell is. Normally people jump 9-cell mains and 7-cell reserves because 9-cell is a bit sportier, you know, whereas a 7-cell is a bit more reliable. Base jumpers use 7-cells, more reliable, and wingsuiters use 7-cells. So I've got 2 7-cells because I do a bit of wingsuiting and also some low altitude stuff, so quite low at the ground. So you want a more reliable canopy. But because of that, it tends to open well, it tends not to twist up, or if it does, it's not a problem. So I've never cut away. Though my mate, who's done the 6,000 jumps, he's got like a tiny, like a Formula One canopy. This thing is like a rocket. And he's cut away 13 times to date.
Fuck.
Yeah. Because if you could even like half a twist in that, you've got to chop it because it's just so fast and so twitchy.
Got you.
But you know, yeah.
The guys that I was jumping with, the tandem guys, I noticed the bag on their back was massive.
Yeah.
And then the wingsuit guy that was filming me, I noticed he had a really small one. Ones I've seen on your Instagram, tiny little thing on his back. Barely looks like he's wearing a parachute.
Yeah.
Is that what you're on about, the 7-cell, 9-cell?
No, that's the size of it. So
fine.
With the actual bit, how much cloth above your head. So it's one of those bizarre things in the UK. We're still half metric and half imperial, but they're measuring imperial. So you would have jumped a tandem or whatever it might be, 320. So that's 320 square feet of fabric material, above your head. More material, obviously with tandem. There's two people, so you need a much more material. Mm. If you were a student, if you started to come to learn to skydive, which we'll also try and convince you by the end of the podcast, you'd probably start with a 280.
Okay.
You know, my new rig that's coming is like a 130.
That was tiny.
Yeah, and then Mikey and Ali, who are both heavier than me, they're jumping like 80s, like tiny, tiny canopies, which means they are
fast,
super fast, super sporty, super maneuverable, but, you know, a bit like a Formula One car. Mm-hmm. If you're not a very good driver and you get a Formula One car, you're just going to keep stalling it and crashing it. You know, like a Formula One car is an amazing machine in the hands of somebody who can drive it.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
yeah,
it's a death trap. So,
what would that process be if someone like me wanted to jump on their own? Like, yeah, how would I learn to do that?
It's pretty straightforward. I mean, so you do what was you if you do one in Dubai, that's different. But when you come back to the UK, you'd probably do another tandem, but this time we call a TAF. So it's a tandem accelerated free fall. So you'd get a lot more information. You wouldn't be a passenger anymore. It'd be more of a team thing. So you'd be much, much more, a better educated for you. All the processes, what was happening. And then in free fall, they'd be getting to do stuff. You'd wear an altimeter as well. And, you know, you'd understand what altitude you want and get to do stuff. And then once they'd pulled the parachute, you'd be given the toggles and you'd be given instructions. So you'd do a lot of the steering. They might take them off just before landing, but you'd be a lot more involved. Then after that, you're going to your level 2 AFF. So that's when you are jumping at the plane on your own. And there's two instructors with you. No, it's fine. There's two instructors with you. You do a ground school first. You do a full ground school that teaches you all the stuff you need to know. And then, so two instructors. One will hold your left arm and left leg. One will hold your right arm and right leg. And as a three of you as a team, you'll leave that aircraft and they'll get you and keep you nice and stable. You do practice pulls, you'll do different maneuvers. And then you pull your own parachute. The guys drop away, they land, and then you're on a radio and they will talk you down. They'll be like, okay, left toggle, right toggle, and they'll steer you in all the way down to landing.
Wow.
You
could do that quite soon.
Oh, yeah, you do seven levels. So you do your TAF or your level one, and you level 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. You've got to sort of pass level. So if you're like super on, if they let go of you in level 3 and you're like mega unstable and they've got to get back on to stabilize you, you have to resit some of the levels.
Got you, fine.
But otherwise, 7 levels, so 7 jumps. And then you're on your consolidation jumps. That's you jumping at the plane on your own, completely on your own, crack on, go for it. So skydiving is one of those things. It's very, very easy to get competent. It's very, very, very difficult to get good.
Like skiing?
Probably, yeah.
You learn it really quickly, but to get good takes ages.
Exactly, yeah. So yeah, to get safe, to be able to leave the aircraft on your own, get stable, pull your parachute the right altitude and land, it's actually pretty straightforward.
It's pretty amazing that you can do something what seems so wild so quickly.
So one of the things about it is you can't take graduate steps. You can do a little bit of training in the wind tunnel, but as I say, that you've got to learn to skydive, you've got to jump out of a plane. It's the bottom line, you've got to jump out of a plane.
Mm.
There's no, you can't go, well, we'll do half a jump out of a plane and then go into the full one. It's like, well, it's either in and you're either in and you're out. And what you'll find, you say that sensory overload, I use exactly the same phrase when talking to students. Because they'll do their level one or their TAF, whatever, and you're looking at level 7. But for level 7, you've got to be able to get out. You do turns to 360 turns left and right. You do a little bit of tracking. You go unstable, then restabilize yourself, all this sort of stuff. And they're like, there's no way we'll have enough time to do that. And like, don't worry about it. By your 7th jump, you'll get all that done, and you'll only be halfway through the skydive. Because all the skydive from 15 grand to about 5 or 6 where they pull is about 60 seconds, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But as you said, it seems to be over in a second.
The whole thing does.
You get like time expansion. By your fourth jump, it'll feel like 20 seconds. And by your seventh jump, it'll feel like a minute, you know. So
got you.
You get over it pretty quickly. You become used to it pretty quickly. I mean, don't be sure, you're still shitting yourself when you leave the aircraft. That takes, you know, can take dozens of jumps to kind of wear off properly. But you will appreciate this and you'll see more, you'll remember more.
Do you still get nervous?
No,
not at all. There's no like point.
It depends what I'm doing. The only thing I get nervous if I'm doing a skydive for something with other people who are much better than me, then I'm always a bit, because I don't want to mess up their jump. I don't want to be the weak link. You know, you don't want to go, oh, Christ, I don't want to be the one who messes up everybody's jump. We've got to redo it or whatever else. So that, but not from a safety point of view, no. You know, I understand it well enough. I've done it long enough that I'm like, if for any reason I was to walk towards the aircraft and be like, a bit like I said with cave diving, I'm like, I'm really fucking nervous. I'm like, don't get in the plane because that's not right. You shouldn't be, not in my state, you shouldn't be feeling. So if you are, maybe your subconscious picked up on something. But I still do all the checks. So even at my level, I get what calls a flight line check, a buddy check. Mm-hmm. So I'll still get my mate, and Mikey's the same. So he's the guy with like 6,000 jumps. It's good for the less experienced guys to see us do this, even at our level. I'll be like, right, cool, give me a check. And he checks me over, make sure everything's still every, you know, all the straps are done up right and, you know, things are in properly and all that. And I've got my altimeter, I've got my helmet that I need, you know, and wander on the plane, forget something. And I do it to him. So yeah, doing those basic checks, you have to guard against complacency. So skydiving can be and is, if you look at the statistics, super safe. It's an incredibly safe sport. Because it's so heavy police, we come under the same laws as, like, you know, Heathrow, because mm-hmm. it all comes under. So I can go and buy some dive kit off eBay and go cave diving tomorrow and kill myself. Or I could buy some climbing kit off eBay tomorrow and go big wall lead climbing and kill myself. But to get on a jump plane requires a huge amount of paperwork checks that's impossible. Like, if you don't know what you're doing, there's no way you'll get close, even close to that aircraft.
Mm, that's good to know.
Yeah.
That makes me feel a little bit better.
Mind you, Dubai. I'm joking.
Yeah. Let's touch on, so stunt performer.
Mm.
Now, this is a job that from the outside sounds like super cool. Sounds like you're doing wicked things and all this sort of stuff. But I always then, we were talking off air that I always feel also the stunt performer, stunt double, I don't know what the correct term is, but they don't really get any credit, right? Because you, as someone sat in a cinema watching a film, if I'm watching, and I gave an example earlier, if I'm watching John Wick, I just presume it's Keanu Reeves doing everything. And there's probably three or four other guys that are getting battered in the background to film all that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the job, to be honest. Like, your job is to do that and then take none of the credit. That's the whole point. You're there to support the actor and you're there to support the movie. And, you know, it's funny, within the stunt community, there's credit given for, like, within, but not like I don't think anyone really wants credit outside the stunt community. So people won't be recognized for an awesome stunt they just did, you know, and there's some absolute legends in the stunt community. But outside of that realm, no one knows who they are. And actually, those guys don't want anyone to know. That's not the point. It's a kind of quite an internal thing. It's quite a, you know, it's weird. I was going to say humble. It is humble. But, like, internally, we all swagger about, we've all got egos.
So when you turn up onto set, you're like a rock star, basically. But from the outside, we don't know that.
There's some guys in the stunt world that have been doing it for years and years and years that are legends that, yeah, they are proper rock stars in the stunt community. But not outside it, you know, the legends only within, because it's quite a kind of closed shop. Like, people, they keep everything in the down low.
How do you get into that? You can't go to university and be a stuntman.
No, there's lots of different ways. I mean, I was lucky that I fell into it quite late in life. You know, I wish I started years ago. So I'm a member of the British Stunt Register.
Yeah.
Which is not a requirement to be a stunt performer in the UK, but it's definitely advisable. Like, you know, 99.9% of people who are out there doing stunts regularly, who make a living from it, are on the British Stunt Register. And there's various disciplines and abilities you've got to show to be able to get on that. And it's a high standard. Driving, you've got six different disciplines, and you can choose which ones you decide to specialize in or whatever. You know, I do underwater stuff, like rope stuff, there's driving, motorbikes, horses, gymnastics, high diving, all that sort of stuff. And then unfortunately miscellaneous, because skydiving isn't one number. My skydiving counted as miscellaneous because you've got to have, for your miscellaneous, it has to be done, some of this relevant to stunts, but all done at a national or international level. You know, so the standard within those disciplines is very, very, very high. Like, I was going to initially do I would always want to be a gymnast. And I thought, right, I'm going to do the gymnastics test. I mean, I'm trained for that. Turns out you shouldn't start trying to be like a high-level gymnast in your 40s. Just breaks you. I was not stiff, pre-broken ex-squaddy trying to be like, it's just not going to work.
Like a roller trying.
No, you've got guys like mates of mine who are ex-like Team GB Olympic gymnasts, Cirque du Soleil gymnasts. It's like, okay, that's not for me. Okay, I'm not that guy. But I had a chance to work on a film, quite a high-end film. And as soon as I get in there, the things that struck me were, don't be wrong, it's well paid.
And I was going to ask that. Is it quite well paid or not?
I think it is. I mean, I'm sure there's people out there, you know, who are on pop star wages who thinks it's terrible money, but I think it's good. And the job is cool. It is. I mean, it's not, you're not doing something every day. A lot of time you're standing around, but being in the forces. But what I loved about that job, which led me to go, yep, I'm going to train my ass off and I'm going to get on the stunt register and I'm going to become part of this, was the people. They were like, I was like, oh, it was the first time since leaving the forces. I'd be like, ah, I'm back with my tribe, man. This is cool. These are like super motivated, super professional, very talented people who are all really nice human beings. Mm-hmm. And they were. I loved going to work. I was so, like, I drive to Pinewood on a Sunday night. And I'm like, I'm looking forward to going to work. Not just, even if I wasn't doing that week, I mean, I might just be making cardboard boxes and moving mats, which is what you do a lot of, to be honest. But I'm like, I'm hanging out with these people who are all awesome. And they are all awesome. Like, it's quite a humbling thing because, you know, I'm pretty good at skydiving. I'm pretty good at diving, all that sort of bits and bobs. But I'm in, you sat at a table and it's like, oh, yeah, he was 3 times world rally champion. And, oh, he was the ex-world motocross champion. And, oh, you know, she's like amazing horse stunt trick rider. And she won these competitions. Oh, there's that guy. He was the decathlete in the 2012 Olympics. And that guy's, you know, the ex-senior acrobat from Cirque du Soleil and a Team GB gymnast in his day. Wow. And you kind of go, oh, that guy was the 7 times world kickboxing champion, undefeated. You know, he left before he was beaten and started doing stunts. You sit this at a table and you go, okay, actually, everybody's cool, you know. There's no point swaggering around these people because everybody's done something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you probably can't say, but any big films that you've worked on that you can talk about that we might know, the listeners may know?
I was a stunt performer on Bond. That's where I got my break. Initially doing the underwater stuff, then doing some rope stuff and other bits and bobs with people.
One of, like, modern Bond?
Yeah. And then
you do look a bit like him, to be fair.
You can come again, darling. I worked on Fast and Furious for a little bit. That was an experience.
Not as Vin Diesel, surely.
No, Jason Momoa.
Are
you? No. You know, got to play your wheelhouse. Some new films coming out this year. I worked on Masters of the Air. I love Bond because it's my start, and I love the people that I work with on Bond. Now, a lot of those guys came to my wedding. One of the guys on it signed the register at my wedding, which was a couple of years ago. Like, that was a life changing experience for me. I did an Apple series called Masters of the Air, mm-hmm. which is like it's like Band of Brothers. People remember that TV series, but for the bomber pilots of World War II. But we did some skydiving stunts on it. And it was like the dream job because the stunt coordinator / director was a really good friend of mine. He's the guy that basically gave me my first break in stunts, called Lee Morrison. And the assistant coordinator was a guy called Dave Grant, who signed the register at my wedding, really, really good mate of mine, and a skydiver. And then there's Ryan Stewart, Dan Griffiths, who are really good mates of mine. I still jump with Dan all the time. We were skydiving, and then my mate Mike Lovemore, who I spoke with, the guy who's got 6,000 jumps and jumps his handkerchief with a parachute, I got him on the job as the cameraman. So we've got this like drop zone to ourselves, right? So they've hired the whole drop zone, we've got our own drop zone, we've got our own plane, and it's like me and all my mates, who frankly, if we weren't doing this job because the weather's quite nice, we'd all be down in a drop zone just jumping for fun together anyway, you know, being paid to do skydiving stunts in this Apple series. I'm like, this is... Yeah. Incredible.
That's awesome.
You know, and it was the best like couple of weeks. It was such good crack. Again, just pinch yourself. It's like, my God, I'm being paid here to dress up in fancy dress costume and jump out of planes in my own private drop zone with my mates.
Yeah, so cool.
And somebody's paying me for this as well.
What's like, I don't know, gnarliest stunt you've done or any injuries from it? Any of them gone wrong?
No, I've been all right. Bumps. I mean, most of my injuries I arrived with, you know, from the forces. I could have turned up pre-broken. But only, no, the worst injury I've had, I tore my ACJ, so my AC joint, which is where your sort of collarbone meets the top of your shoulder. And that bone is then obviously pinned down like guy lines by ligaments and tendons there. And I did a film that's not out yet, I don't think. But anyway, it was World War II. And it's a flooding subway, and they drop these like massive amounts of water, and it's like almost a tidal wave hits the platform, and me and this other guy got washed into the pit where the rails are for the tube station. It's London in the 1940s, basically. So we've done that for a couple of days.
And that was what was meant to happen, right?
Yeah. It was one of the tube stations did get flooded in the Blitz. So this happens, they drop this muscle weight, we get sort of smashed around and dumped into the pit. And that, we did it for a couple of days, it was fine, but just one time, I, whatever reason, didn't, it just took me and I didn't manage to correct, I'm not entirely sure what happened, but anyway, I hit the middle rail down the pit, because you're falling into it, and I hit it my shoulder, and I hit it so hard, I came up and I was like dazed. Like, even though I didn't hit my head, I hit so hard, I was like, geez, I was all like, whoa, my God, I'm like a bit woozy. But I hit my shoulder so hard from the side that it popped my collarbone out. But the problem is, that was like 10 o'clock in the morning, the rest of the day to go. So just taped it down and kind of crack on. But that, again, that's not, that sounds like, you know, check me out, what a hero. That's standard practice. The guy's like, all right, mate, you just need to crack on.
If you don't do a job, you don't get paid either.
Well, yeah, and I went to the room and, you know, and a couple of the other standing lads, I was like, my shoulder's not great. And when the lads, his next gymnast, he's always like that, impressive. He wasn't sort of senior guy. He's actually a coordinator, but he was doing sort of just normal stunts on the ground for that day. He's like, oh, yeah, it's your AC joint. I've done them both. And one of the guys is like, oh, yeah, I've done that. And loads of the boys and like, well, all you can do is just, they taped it round with like, you know, that kinetic sort of tape. Which was actually not too bad because it basically was acting as doing the job that the tendons and ligaments meant to do, just holding that bone down. They just taped that down and we cracked on for the rest of the day. I was obviously probably a little bit more careful, but yeah.
That is so cool. We know when if you're given a stunt performing job and it's for a film, let's say it's for Bond film, do you have to spend much time kind of studying the actor that you're playing to move like them?
No, most of the stuff I do isn't like I'm just in the background doing stuff. Like, but there's when I've done a little bit of doubling, then yeah, it depends on the thing. Like, I've done
on the scene, I guess.
Yeah, I've done some dealing with driving. That wasn't an issue, you know. And a lot of times. And I've done for people on like TV shoots, like low budget TV stuff. And, you know, I don't really look much like them. So it's fine because the cameras, they're going to get the shots they need without seeing that it's you. The whole point is they don't know it's you. I mean, I'm sure there's some guys out there who double the same people again. I make mine doubles Idris Elba all the time. So, you know, he physically looks like him. And I would imagine he spent enough time and he's probably learnt, how he moves and watching that sort of stuff. So, yes, that is required at a certain level. But the majority of stuff I do, I mean, either not required or I'm literally, you know, I'm you know, henchman number 12 who gets blown up in the background. So no one, it's kind of irrelevant.
Yeah, yeah. I've got a friend locally that lives where I live who doubles David Beckham.
All right.
And he looks like a spit of him. Whenever we go out, everyone's like, fucking, it's David Beckham. But so he's done, I think, some of the H&M advert, you know, when he was running in his boxers.
Okay.
Some of the time running, it was actually my pal rather than Beckham. So he looks very similar.
So Beckham employs him to double him?
Yeah. I don't know if it's Beckham, but he's met Beckham a few times. Okay. Well, so the only person he doubles is Beckham because he looks very similar sort of sleeve tattoos. They obviously paint a few of them on depending on the shot. But it's pretty amazing.
Because in stunts, you actually don't want to be like that too much because otherwise...
You're pigeonholed,
aren't you? Yeah, you don't want to just be doing one actor and that's it because that actor might...
Never do another meal.
Well, not so much that, but might do a load of dramas. And if there's no stunts in it...
Yeah.
It's not good. So you want to be kind of... Being generic's no bad thing. It's actually... A lot of the stunt guys obviously are very fit, athletic men and women. But... Sometimes if you're like really short or really skinny, I can get you loads of work because actually a lot of actors are short and skinny. There's not that many stunt guys, like, you know.
You sort of blend in, don't you, I guess, with the...
Yeah, you know, there's a lot, because the stunt register, there's a lot of people who are ex-gymnasts or ex-martial artists. You know, there's a massive amount of, frankly, kind of 5'8", 5'9", 5'10", athletic-looking white guys. There's a lot of, so, you know. If you're like... If you're a bloke who wanted to get in the stunt register and you're 4'11", you're probably going to get a lot of work, frankly, you know. Or if you're 7 feet tall, you're probably going to get a lot of work.
There's another local lad where I live who's trying to get on this register at the moment. He's doing his training. I notice he keeps going to like Legoland and doing the diving off the top.
Oh, yeah.
And he keeps like putting videos up of him doing loads of gymnastic stuff, loads of diving. I think it's all the things you're talking about,
He'll
the disciplines.
Well. Yeah, most of there's tests for most things.
He's got some work in the background as well. He's done a bit, I think he's done a bit in Star Wars and a few bits, but he's not yet, his aim is to get on that register you're talking about because he said it will just elevate his.
Yeah.
And he is about, he doesn't look too dissimilar to you. He's not quite as muscular, but he's kind of similar sort of hair. He's probably 10 years younger than you, Mike.
What?
maybe 15 years younger. But he does martial arts as well. And, you know, that's how I met him. And, he does some sort of knife and disarming and stuff like that, and teaches some shit down south.
Sounds like he'll be he'll do well.
He's good, yeah.
I mean that's the meat, you know, the meat and drink for some guys is falling over, and that's kind of, that's what we tend to do, is fall over.
Because you got like Jackie Chan. Is it Jackie Chan does all his own?
Yeah, yeah, he's a legend.
Does all of his own, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Is that real?
Yeah.
I know, oh, I read that online somewhere. But
100%, yeah. It's just the early days. I mean,
even those weird like bamboo jumping scenes, you know what he's like?
I mean, he's an actor, stroke stuntman, stroke coordinator, stroke fight coordinator. I mean, that's all, yeah, he's a one-man stunt team, is Jackie Chan.
Mad.
Yeah. But then again, it's very impressive. We don't want actors to do that. Otherwise, there's no work for stunt performers. So, you know, you want actors who are like, no, let the stunt double do it. Great, cool. But see, a lot of our work isn't actually doubling actors. Most of the work I've ever done, you're in the back, you are playing henchman number 9. So the body attacks the base, and you know, the hero is shooting everyone, and you're one of the guys who gets shot.
Yeah. So that's what my mate's doing a lot of, the one that's trying to get him registered. So he's not like doubling a main character.
Yeah.
He's just one of the guys in the gang or in the war or whatever it might be.
And
it does sound fun though.
Oh, it is. It's great fun. And it's just nice people, and it's you know.
And he's met some. He's a bit, as I said, he's a bit younger than you. He's met some quite big names, I think, which is quite exciting, I guess, for him.
And I've been very lucky. I am absolutely positive that I know for a fact there are some massive dickheads out there, but I've been very lucky that everyone I've worked with, who is you know, a more senior actor, all been lovely, genuinely. My experience, all been up fine. There's been one or two that I've been like. Yeah, they're cool. They're all right. But yeah, even the ones that have had a reputation for being like difficult or problematic, certainly when I've met them, on the day I met them, and my interaction with them was absolutely fine, not a problem at all. So maybe it's me. Maybe it's my charming personality.
Yeah, they're frightened of you. Andy, what's next for you, mate? What you got planned? What's in the pipeline?
The most immediate thing, I'm doing some filming tomorrow up at Warner Brothers, and then... I think that's mostly it. And then we're prepping, because it's summer holidays are coming up. Mm-hmm. I said before, I've got two kids. So we are going to pack my wife and kids into the camper van, and we're going to drive down the south coast of France, the old Côte d'Azur.
Lovely.
And we're going to camp on the beach, because I thought Côte d'Azur, quite a market, but camp on the beach, it's like I said before, the living a 100 grand lifestyle on a 20 grand budget. So we're there for like, I think a month, we're just going to camp on the beach. And I've got to fly back for the middle of the week just for some more filming. And then I'll fly straight back out there. But yeah, that's the next thing, is like me, Beck, my missus, and the two boys.
What fun life they must be having, mate, by the sounds of all that.
Yeah, and I've already briefed them up with the drills, because they love water. It's the easiest thing in the world. All you've got, as long as there's a swimming pool or the sea, painting's easy.
Really?
So I've already briefed them up, like, right, we go in the sea, we have breakfast, we go in the sea, we have lunch, we go in the sea, we have dinner, and then we go to bed because you've been knackered. That's it for a month, pretty much.
Yeah, love it.
Yeah, get a spearfishing license when I get out there, and then I'll actually try and get up early and go spearfishing first thing in the morning myself, and that'll get us lunch.
Are you actually cook and eat the catch?
Yeah. I mean, spearfishing in the UK as well, it's actually quite easy in the UK. You don't need a license around like where you're like Dorset, Devon, Cornwall's great for it. You know, I always check about what the fishing stocks are like. So the Marine Conservation Society have got a little app that tells you what fish stocks are like. So because the great thing about spearfishing is, unlike normal fishing, is I can eyeball the fish and decide if that's the right species and the right size for me to ethically take. But things like pollock, you know, sometimes bass, cod, whatever's okay for that time of year. Mullet, not so much. I'm not a big fan of mullet. But in France, it's absolutely fine. There's certain rules. You've got to have a license, which costs like 50 euros for the year. And you've got to do it minimum 200 metres from like beaches. Again, makes sense safety wise. So yeah, my intention is to try and most mornings try and get someone for lunch before everybody wakes up.
Well, I look forward to seeing that on Instagram.
We'll see.
Mate, it's been awesome speaking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure, man. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Cheers.